you're a fan of Offshore, you're gonna love Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. It's one of my personal favorites. Host Al Letson and reporters take you to places all over the world, like a small migrant boat on the open waters off the coast of Libya, or the streets of Chicago, to find out why 250,000 Black residents have left the city since 2000. It's not just important journalism. It's also really good listening. In one of their recent episodes, reporters analyzed 31 million mortgage records and found African Americans and Latinos are routinely denied home loans at rates far higher than white counterparts in several cities. Reveal reporters zero in on two loan applicants, one Black and one white, and go deep into bringing to light a pretty crazy statistic. The gap in homeownership between African Americans and whites is now wider than it was during the Jim Crow era. You don't want to miss this one. You can find Reveal on iTunes or anywhere you get your podcasts. Learn more at revealnews.org.
Hey, London, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll keep it quick. So we're in Majuro. We haven't been able to meet your...
It's our third day in the Marshall Islands, and I'm calling to update London Marshall Lewis on the search for his family. So far, we haven't been able to track down his brother or his sister. We did meet a woman named Nerje Joseph, who thought her son was London's biological father. But what followed was a wild goose chase across the island, trying to talk to family members, the adoption fixer who worked with London's mother, anyone who might be able to confirm his paternity.
He had two children that your biological mom and him had together that they put up for adoption.
Am I one of those two, or?
I don't think you're one of those two.
Okay.
But it does mean, at the very least, that you are pretty closely related because it's your sister's grandmother to one of the 22 last living survivors from Wrong Lap of the Castle Bravo test.
Oh, wow. I think that's like really cool for me, at least, as a historian.
Yeah,
able to have that kind of connection.
I think she'd love to meet you while she's still alive and tell you her stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would love to hear, too. I love that. Feels like there's a lot of people I have to go meet soon.
From Honolulu Civil Beat, this is Offshore, Stories from Hawaii. I'm Jessica Terrell. This is episode 7 of The Blood Calls. We're nearing the end of the season, so if you haven't heard the other episodes, definitely go back and check them out first. You'll want to know more about London Lewis and the adoption boom that started in the Marshall Islands in the 90s and has followed the Marshallese to places like Springdale, Arkansas today. London isn't the only Marshallese adoptee asking questions about who they are and where they come from. And there are plenty of parents searching for the children they gave up too. But reunions aren't easy. Many families have been separated for years, by not only distance, but also language and culture. Finding their way back to each other is not a simple matter of making a phone call or buying a plane ticket. It's a complicated journey that can lead to places no one expects.
My name is Nerje Joseph. I was born in 1948, and I was there when the bomb dropped in 1954.
Nerje wants London to come to the Marshall Islands, to hear the story of what happened to her, to his family, his people. And he may get there, may get to sit and lay his head on her shoulder, so to speak, and hear her story. But I think it's an important story for us, for the world, to hear too. Castle Bravo was the largest nuclear weapon ever detonated by the U.S. The bomb vaporized three islands in Bikini Atoll, sucked up all the trees, the sand, water, into the atmosphere as radioactive particles. Traces from Bravo would be discovered as far away as Kansas. Wrong Lap, where Nerje is from, was a mere 75 miles away.
Yo, you born in Rano, my kigi, kami kigi, mrojagayan, ipolak.
We were sleeping at that time, that morning, and we woke up to like loud booms, thunderous sounds. Then when we went outside, we saw several rainbows everywhere. They were all shocked, like asking each other, what's all these? What's going on? But she was little and she didn't really pay attention to it. You were just getting ready to go to school. Ashes started to fall everywhere. She compares the ashes to snow. Ashes were everywhere on their crops, in their homes.
Did she hide from the ash? I heard maybe there were children playing in it.
They didn't hide. She didn't hide from the powders, but it fell on their food. They were eating it. It fell on their water, and they were drinking it. And then she was playing, like holding these powders on, with her hands. And then she remembers when she put her on her hair, all her hair fell off. And later that night, it got darkest. She'd never experienced such darkness before, that they had to use coconut leaves to light up. And Turupu got so dark that they had to yell, like, where are you? Even there next to each other.
Was she scared? Were her parents scared?
We had no idea what was going on. We kept on wondering what's going on, what's happening to us.
The U.S. military didn't send medical aid to Nerje and the islanders on Rong Lap until 3 days after the detonation.
When they returned from Ejij, they used to call them the Rubams, people of the bombs. But even then, she vaguely understands what that is. But now that she's old, and from learning from the news and what she's hearing all over, they just found out that what was dropped was bomb.
What happened to her parents?
Back in 1960, mother died because she could no longer swallow food.
In the mid-80s, after years of suffering from terrible illnesses and miscarriages, giving birth to stillborn babies with birth defects too terrible for women to put into words, the Rong Lapese asked for help relocating. The U.S. government ignored their pleas, so the Marshallese turned to Greenpeace. When Greenpeace arrived, women from Rong Lap stood on the beach holding signs to welcome the ship that would carry them away from their home. The sign said, "We love the future of our kids." But now Nerje's children are grown. Her grandchildren, even the ones who were adopted out, the ones she's lost touch with, are grown too.
They said the island is still poisonous. But what she's saying is, what's the difference? I want to go back because I already tasted, I already ate it.
So does she want to go back?
I really want to go back. I really want to go and then die there because it's my home.
I asked Nerje if there's anything she wants Americans in general to know about what happened to her. And she says no.
They already know what's going on. They know what happened.
And this is the part of the interview where I have to try not to choke up, because we don't.
It's called incomplete history or hidden history.
That's Alsen Killen. He runs a cultural and vocational training program for youth in Majuro.
When I went to high school in Hawaii, I learned U.S. history, American history. I learned the Hawaiian history. I did not see nuclear testing, but that was still part of the American history. That's part of Hawaiian history. It's important for the world to know that, to keep that story alive.
Alsen's family is from Bikini.
I was actually born on Kwajalein Atoll. It's known as the Ronald Reagan Missile Range.
2 decades after the U.S. started using Bikini as a bombing range, the U.S. said the atoll was safe to return to. So Alsen's family moved back. Every few months, scientists and doctors from the Department of Energy would come to Bikini and check people for radiation levels.
They call it body count. Check our health.
Olsen and his friends would collect shells for the scientists to test.
And I was so happy because we'd go to the beach and collect shells and take it to them and they give us candies. In 77, 78, they said, wow, radiation level in their body, it's too much. We made a mistake. You guys should get relocated from Bikini again.
How much the military knew about the impact of radiation is still up for debate. But listen to this military film clip about testing the Bikinians for radiation. I think the narration, the tone of how they talk about the Bikinians, speaks for itself.
These are fishing people, savages by our standards. The Marshallese, caught by fallout, got 175 wrenches of radiation. Most humans are exposed to less than 20 wrenches in a lifetime. John, as we said, is a savage, but a happy, amenable savage.
Olsen was 10 years old when his family left Bikini for the second and last time.
When we left Bikini, we were on the ship. You know, I was so excited because you don't see ship on Bikini. You don't see ship except for the scientist ships every 3 months. And I remember when the ship started to leave, I see people, you know, kind of, you know, like I run to my mom and she was crying and my dad, everybody were crying. And I said, what's going on? We're going on a cruise and everybody's crying. And of course, you know, when I grew up, a lot of news media would come in to see my folks. And they would ask the same question, what were the feeling? And I learned from my parents that they were actually saying goodbye to the island that they're probably not going to see forever. That was the last time they saw the islands.
In 1946, when the Bikinians were first asked to leave their atoll for atomic testing, the U.S. military officer in charge of the operation compared the Bikinians to the children of Israel, whom he said, the Lord saved from their common enemy and led into the promised land.
Well, at least the children of Israel, you know, they know that there is something that they're going to find. We have nothing to look forward to. There is no promised land. So the people of Bikini are on a journey without an end. It's like we're going into a dark tunnel. The light at the end of the tunnel hasn't been, it's not even in the story yet. We're drifting. Climate change is the same animal as the radiation. We got relocated from Bikini because of radiation. Now we see climate change standing in place. Mother Nature standing in place. One day we might get relocated again, but this time not from our island, but from our country.
The Marshallese experienced terrible suffering in the 20th century. And the threat of climate change to their future is so great, one Marshallese leader compared it to cultural genocide. But it would be a mistake to think of them as helpless victims. They aren't going to lose their islands without a fight. In recent years, they've filed international lawsuits against the U.S. to try and block nuclear proliferation, led blockades of coal shipments to raise awareness about climate change. But we have to talk about the power dynamics here, because it's a part of the nuclear legacy, but also the struggle to regulate adoptions.
There's something unique, I think, about the relationship between the United States and the Marshall Islands that sets up greater potential, and there's a history of it, of exploitation.
That's Julie Walsh. She's a professor at the Center for Pacific Island Studies at the University of Hawaii. Her research focus is Marshall Islands history and Marshallese-U.S. relations. She's also been involved in tracking Marshallese adoption issues since the 90s.
You know, the U.S. tested nuclear weapons in these islands, right? The U.S. determines how much money in the compact goes to different ministries just because they control the committee that determines the funding.
London's story, the Marshallese adoption story, it's about the relationship between adoptive families and birth families. But it's also about the relationship between a family of nations.
it's hard to deny the power that the United States has had over the Marshall Islands. And then in these interpersonal relationships, it plays out in the same way that sort of nation to nation it does.
Those same power imbalances can play out in individual families, especially when adoptive parents and birth parents are coming from cultures with such a different concept of adoption. A growing number of adopting parents are starting to embrace the Marshallese tradition of adoption. Of adoption as something that grows both families, creates new bonds. But even as more people embrace this idea of blended families, the adopting parents are the ones who hold more power, who get to say when and how contact is made, if photos are sent, if they want to stay in touch at all. The Marshallese are part of the family unit, but the U.S. is still at the head of the table. We wanted to take a moment to share with you a message from one of our offshore members, Wyatt Gordon.
Aloha. My name is Wyatt Gordon, and I decided to become a donating member of Civil Beat specifically to support the Offshore podcast. In an era of fake news and declining local journalism, Civil Beat and the Offshore podcast provide the invaluable service of quality local journalism to Honolulu, Hawaii, and the entire Pacific.
Members like Wyatt receive exclusive bonus content, limited edition offshore laptop stickers, and updates on current and future projects. A warm mahalo to Wyatt and new major donors Justin Gonzor and Jeffrey Morrill. We can't do this without you. To make a donation, visit offshorepodcast.org/donate. offshorepodcast.org/donate.
And this is the daughter that is in the state.
Aww.
The one that my girlfriend gave away.
How do you have her photo?
From her.
That's Jed. He's a translator who worked with reporter Emily Dugdale during our trip to the Marshall Islands. A few years ago, Jed's girlfriend left Majuro for the U.S. without telling Jed that she was putting their child up for adoption.
Do you know about the family that she's with now?
I have no idea. She doesn't tell me. I ask her, but she don't tell me anything. She just sends me a picture of her telling me she's doing all right. Yeah, she'll come back when she's older.
But it'll be different, you know?
Yeah.
The blood calls. The children will come back to us. We've heard this from a lot of Marshallese birth parents. But Jed is actually speaking from his own experience.
Same like me. When I was young, I got adopted. Got older, I came back.
Jed was adopted with his three brothers when he was 9 years old, during the big adoption boom in the 90s.
Yeah, 15 years in Michigan. Long time.
There was a lot he liked about the U.S. He experienced winter for the first time, learned how to snowboard. But he stayed in touch with his biological family, and he came back to the Marshall Islands in 2012 when he found out his biological mom died. Even though he spent the first 9 years of his life living in the Marshall Islands, after being gone for 15 years, it was hard for him to readjust.
Came back, didn't know how to speak Marshallese. Took me 2 years to learn Marshallese.
Despite the learning curve, Jed's put down roots in Majuro. He now has a son, and they live with his grandma in a house near the center of town. He works as a translator for a local religious group, and he just started a new job as a security guard at a grocery store. In some ways, Jed is an adoption success story. He's been able to keep connected to two sets of families and cultures. But now there's little he can do but hope that his daughter, who is swept up in the next cycle of adoptions, will be able to do the same. Many Marshallese birth parents like Jed are still searching for their children, wondering what they look like, if they'll ever get to meet them. But things can get really complicated when families do find each other. Sometimes the reunions aren't so rosy. That's Joni. She gave up her daughter Ramona for adoption almost 2 decades ago. Joni wanted to speak to us because she was still searching for her.
If she's listening, if her daughter is listening, Ramona, she wants you to know that she loved you when she gave you up. It wasn't her interest. She didn't want to give her up at the time. But please know that you are loved, and I really want to know what's happening to you.
We did end up finding Ramona. And her name's not Ramona anymore. It's Shelby Bender. She grew up in a small town in Ohio, where she was more likely to be read as Asian than Pacific Islander. Her friends actually call her Ling for, let's just say, some very un-PC reasons.
I got that in school because I was good at doing nails. No, a lot of people think I'm just Chinese and Asian.
Like London, there weren't many resources for Shelby growing up to help her tap into Marshallese culture.
I mean, I had interest, but as life went on, I just kind of forgot about it.
But she did wonder what it would be like to meet her birth mom.
What would you think you would do if you met her? What would you say to her if you were there and she was in front of you, you know?
Well, I mean, if I met her, I'd definitely, like, give her a hug and, like, show her, like, that I missed her. But after that, I don't know where the conversation might lead to.
It took us several months to find Shelby. And by the time we did, Joni had actually already found her, and the two had reconnected. But the reunion wasn't at all what Shelby imagined.
She just keeps asking me, like, Ramona, like, can you help me? I need money. Like, I need money.
Shelby said Joni and two of her biological brothers started Facebook chatting with her last fall. When they first got in touch with her, they asked her how she was doing, if she was working. And then the conversation quickly turned to money.
It upset me to the point where I just don't. It's not like I don't want contact with her. It's just that I don't want to, like, have conversation with her. So all she's going to ask is for money, you know?
Shelby says Joni kept asking her when she was going to get paid next. Told her she needed money to help her son in Majuro, who needed medical treatment. But Shelby doesn't have that kind of money. She recently got laid off from a job at KFC and had just started working again at a pizza place. In reality, her family is struggling to make ends meet.
I was rarely disappointed. My mom over here, I was talking to her about it. I kind of got emotional, and I was like, I just don't want to deal with that if she's just going to ask me for money.
In the Marshall Islands, it's not strange to ask family for financial help. Sending children away to be raised in the U.S. is for some women, especially the ones who thought their kids would return, a strategy to lift up the entire family. We talked about this cultural confusion with one of our translators, and she told us that daughters are especially important. There's a saying in Marshallese that the daughters are the basket facing towards the mother. So in some of these women's minds, they shouldn't even have to ask for help. Whether the child was raised by them or not, they're always going to be their child. And family helps family. But so much of this is lost in translation when Marshallese mothers reunite with their American children.
He's coming. He's going to point it out for us. Is it recording?
Yeah.
Reunions can be complicated, painful. But right now, our biggest challenge with London's family is helping a reunion happen at all.
We woke up a guy I know from Ibai because he knows the neighborhood and he's going to help us point to where Francis Orange apartments are.
Awesome. Yowei.
Yowei.
Thank
Dennis,
you.
Dennis, Jessica, Jessica, yes. Dennis.
Thank you for helping us. Mm-hmm. You want me to stay?
Please.
Yep, I'll stay. So Hillary and the guy that we picked up are walking out to a kind of one-story apartment complex, kind of like what you'd see in California with like a little grassy courtyard. And they told me to stay in the car. I think it really freaks people out when a foreign reporter with a microphone shows up at their door. So they're going over to see if they can track down London's brother, John. So he's coming back. He looks happy. Hillary looks happy. What's up?
That's John.
All right, we found Lennon's brother.
Come meet John. John just.
Hi.
Hi.
John Larry.
Yeah.
Wow, we've been looking for you. It's very excited to meet you.
The power's out at John's apartment. So we go sit outside in the yard while his neighbor goes to get us a few beers to share.
My name is Sean, Sean Larry.
I feel like I have so many questions for him because he doesn't know much of anything except his mother's name. That's all he really knew until like last week. Where were you living when your brother was born?
In Rita.
So what do you remember about him? Just he was a little baby and you held him? Did you play with him at all?
Yeah. So I miss you, brother, but...
Did your mom tell you, like, why he was going away or where he was going to?
She said that they were going to adopt him and they'll bring him back.
Is there something you'd want to say to him?
Don't visit. Bring money.
Bring money to me because I'm
Kashmiri people. Come take care of me because I used to take care of you.
Okay, yeah.
He's kidding anyway.
There isn't enough cell service to call London from John's house. So we all hop in the car and head downtown together. Back to the shipping container where the offshore reporting crew has been staying.
Hey, London.
Hey,
well, it's a little breaking up, but I'm here with your brother. I'm going to get some...
By the time we found John, relatives in Metro had given him a heads up that we were searching for him. Andy's had a 30-minute car ride to get ready. London, on the other hand, only got a heads up about 5 minutes ago that we actually found his brother and were going to call.
Hi, Reba.
Hey, John, how you doing?
It's good. I miss you. Do you want to come back?
How are you?
I'm fine.
Yeah, I do want to come back. I want to come back soon.
We've been running around town, chasing so many dead ends, trying to find London's family, that by the time we get him on the phone with his brother, Hillary and I are practically giddy. John and London, they've both imagined this moment, but there's no denying the awkwardness when it actually happens. How do you even begin to reconnect? What do you say to someone who doesn't really speak your language, who loves you without knowing you at all?
You know, our mom was already dead.
No, I didn't. I didn't know that until Anne-Marie told me last week or 2 weeks ago. Mm.
So we have Hillary here, who's a translator, and he's going to jump in just a little bit to help answer some questions. Okay, London.
All right. So let me say it. He remembers the day that you were taken, and he said when he didn't hear from you, when y'all's mother died, he was worried because he wanted to tell you, to the point where like when he grew up later in life, he got mad and he wanted to find you. He almost went to the courthouse to dig in for documents and information and how to reach out to you.
I guess it was the shock when I was taken, then, right?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, it was a kind of shock to him.
Do we have any other brothers and sisters?
Yeah, four.
Four?
Yeah.
Yeah, I always wanted a brother.
London tells John that he will try to come visit, but it may be a year before he can get the time and funds to make the journey.
We will definitely keep in touch.
I'm always thinking about you, man. So I really miss you. I love you.
Yeah. I love you too, John. I will come out to come see you. You know, to reconnect and everything.
Okay.
Talk to you again, eh? That's so. Right. See you.
Yeah.
Love you. Bye.
Yeah, love you too. Bye, John.
Yeah. Bye. Bye, London. What?
Hey, London, it's Jess.
Oh, hey, Jess.
Hey, just wanted to see how you were doing and how you were feeling.
Oh, I feel good. I was actually...
I step outside after they hang up to check in with London and see if he's doing okay. He says yeah, but that he's basically at a loss for words. Doesn't know what to think or feel. Back inside, London's brother is a lot less reserved. He's laughing and tearing up a little at the same time.
How are you doing? How do you feel right now?
I'm good. I feel good. Because I first time I'm talking to my friends. But because I really need to, hug him, eh? Like that. All thing. So like before, like six, like young baby.
From Honolulu Civil Beat, this is Offshore, Stories from Hawaii. I'm Jessica Terrell. In our last episode of the season, we're going to come back to the U.S. for some big updates on what's happening with Marshallese adoptions right now. In the search for London's birth father, we're going to finally meet someone who can give us a few answers about his birth mom. Offshore is produced by Honolulu Civil Beat, a nonprofit, community-supported news organization dedicated to building an engaged community with news you can trust. Our producers this season are April Estrelon and Emily Dugdale. Our executive producer is Patty Epler. Editorial consulting was provided by Lantigua Williams & Co. Our engineer is Jackie Sujiko. We'll be back.